Chapter 4. The house on Gooseberry Lane has been home to Cork since his birth. Within its walls he's grown from infancy to adulthood, as have his children, and now his grandson is being raised there. The house is two stories, painted white, with a covered porch that runs the full length of the front, and a stately elm in the front yard, planted when Cork was an infant. Some things in a person's life are often taken for granted, but for Cork, the comfort this house has provided him and his family is a blessing for which he never fails to feel a deep sense of gratitude. He finds his son-in-law, Daniel Bissonnette, and Wabu in the kitchen, where they've set up a complicated Hot Wheels racetrack on the linoleum. There are ramps and tunnels, and Daniel and Wabu are so deeply involved in their play and making so much engine noise between them that they don't notice Cork standing in the doorway, watching. Daniel is Rainey's nephew, and like her, a member of the Lacouturay Band of Lake Superior Chippewa out of Wisconsin. He's employed as a natural resources officer by the Iron Lake Band of Ojibwe. With Jenny, he shares a passion for the written word. Cork's daughter has published two novels based on true events in the lives of the O'Connors. Daniel is an accomplished poet. Cork knows little about poetry, and although he likes what he's read by Daniel, he has to admit that sometimes the deeper meanings escape him. "Hey, Baba!" Wabu cries when he finally notices his grandfather. But he doesn't stop his play. Daniel looks up and grins. "We'll dismantle everything before we start fixing supper." He rises from the floor. "Let me talk to your grandpa a while, Wabu." He and Cork sit at the kitchen table while the little boy continues with his racing and racing noises. "When I picked up Wabu at Sam's place, Jenny told me about the guy who asked you to look for his wife. I found the woman with Henry." Rainey had just guided her in a sweat. "And did you convince Mrs. Morisseau that she should talk to her husband?" "Turns out the man who's looking for her isn't who he claims to be." "Not her husband? Who is he?" "I don't know yet. I've been trying to call him, but getting nothing. I just came from talking with Marcia Dross. She's going to have her guys keep an eye out. He shouldn't be too hard to spot. He's driving a black Escalade." Cork hears fast steps coming down the stairway in the other room. A moment later, Stephen sweeps into the kitchen, carefully dances around the racetrack on the floor, and makes for the cookie jar on the counter, which is shaped like Ernie from Sesame Street. "Hey, Dad." He pulls out a chocolate chip cookie and reaches into the refrigerator for milk. "Did you talk to Henry?" Once again, Cork relates the events of the afternoon. "The guy's an imposter? No kidding. Why?"
"Good question."
Wabu finally notices Stephen and the cookie.
"Can I have one?"
Stephen says, "Ask your dad." Daniel shakes his head. "You had one when we got home."
"Please?
How about I give him half of mine?" Stephen offers.
"A reasonable compromise," Cork puts in.
Daniel throws his hands up in surrender.
"I'm outnumbered, but nothing more till dinner, Wabu."
Stephen breaks the cookie, gives half to the little boy, and says to Cork, "Can I be there when you ask the phony Morisseau what's going on?"
"I've got to find him first, and I need you to do me a favor."
"Sure."
"Rainey's coming by in a while. I'm going back to Crow Point with her to talk some more with Dolores Morisseau. A few more details to nail down. Would you mind closing Sam's place for me tonight?" Stephen pauses with what's left of his cookie halfway to his mouth.
"Maybe I have a date?"
Cork gives his son a skeptical look. "When was the last time you asked a girl out?" Stephen eyes the half cookie in his hand and sighs.
"I'll cover for you."
By the time Daniel clears the Hot Wheels track from the kitchen floor and begins putting supper together, Rainey still isn't home.
Cork has tried calling her cell phone but hasn't been able to connect.
I'm heading out, he tells Daniel. Maybe she's on her way, Daniel says.
Then I'll run into her, Cork says, and we'll be back for supper together.
When he takes off in his expedition, the sun is low on the horizon. Cork reckons he has just enough daylight left for his purpose. He arrives at the double trunk birch and finds Rainey's dusty pickup still parked there. As he sets out for Crow Point, the trail before him is sunk deep in the long shadows of early evening. He's brought a flashlight for the return journey just in case he ends up lingering at Henry's cabin. The air is cooling rapidly and he wears his jean jacket. He has no concrete reason to be concerned, but a sense of uneasiness has settled on him and he can't shake it. He thinks about what Malou has told him, that if he stills all the voices in his head and listens, the woods will speak to him. But that evening all he hears is the quiet after the birds have gone to roost and the swoosh of the wild grass brushing against his boots and pant legs. When he breaks from the trees, he pauses. The sun has been below the horizon for a while, but the soft blue afterglow lights Crow Point. Although supper time has passed, Rainey or Malou would have prepared a meal, and the good aromas that always permeate the air at mealtime should still be lingering. But there's no such smell in the air. And on the far side of the meadow, no hint of wood smoke rising from the stovepipe of either cabin. He can see that Malou's door stands open. By now, the old Midday should have been aware of his presence in the mysterious way he always seems to know. Cork doesn't need the woods to tell him that something isn't right. He approaches cautiously. When he steps into the open doorway of Malou's cabin, he sees that nothing is amiss. The place looks just as he left it. He goes to Leah Dooling's cabin, where Rainey has been staying, and opens the door. Here, too, all seems normal. Parked next to this cabin is a side-by-side ATV that Leah typically uses when she goes into Alouette. Generally, Malou refuses to ride in the machine. Despite his age, he still prefers to walk the several miles to the reservation community. An outcropping of rock stands on the west side of the meadow. Cork follows a well-worn path through the outcrop to a ring of stones where for decades Malou has built fires, often for sacred purposes. There's no fire in the circle of stones, and when Cork feels the ash and char, it's cold. Finally, he checks the sweat lodge. There's residual warmth from the sweat that afternoon, but nothing else. He stands looking beyond the birches and aspens that line the shore of Iron Lake, stares at the dark water, concerned by the emptiness on Crow Point. He knows that Malou often takes to the woods for rambles that can last a day or sometimes more. The old man prefers to go alone, something that worries Leah and Rainey no end. Cork has been less concerned. Malou knows these woods better than any human being, knows how to survive under any circumstance of weather. He wonders if maybe Malou has gone for an evening stroll and the women have insisted on accompanying him. That's the most reasonable speculation. Still, it doesn't sit well with him. He returns to Malou's cabin and once again inspects the place. This time he notices something he missed before. There has always been an ancient Winchester rifle resting on a rack on Malou's cabin wall. The rifle is gone. Cork goes to a shelf where he knows Malou keeps the cartridges for the Winchester in an old tin can. The can is empty. He steps into the evening air where the light in the sky is fading rapidly and spends several minutes trying to clear his head of all other voices so that he might hear what the woods have to tell him. Then he says, "God damn it all to hell," and searches the ground for any signs that may indicate which direction Malou and Rainey and Dolores Morisseau must have gone. In doing so, he discovers a circumstance he can't quite interpret. Over the years, the ground between the cabins has been worn bare of grass and is usually covered with a layer of soft dirt. There are always footprints left by those who live on the point and those who visit. But the dirt that evening has been swept clean, not a print left to read. Cork stares at the blank slate of the ground, bewildered. Finally, he stands alone in the shadow of approaching night with the darkening north woods before him, the abandoned cabins at his back, and beyond them, the shiny blue-black mercury surface of Iron Lake. In the still, oppressive air of that emptied place, he asks himself the same question Dolores Morisseau put to him earlier that day. What kind of private investigator are you? At that moment, the answer is painfully obvious.